Hey, Lily. You know, one of the best talks I've seen in recent years is the one that Jana Bastow did at Mind the Product back in 2017. It's the one where she starts off by talking about how people are complicated.
Oh, yeah. Randy, that is a good one. But why are you bringing that up today? We've talked to Jana before, but she's not here with us today.
No, not Jana, but our guest today is someone who uses her background in behavioral science to actually explain how people work, and then uses that to build better products. And she's got the receipts to back it up.
Aha, you're talking about Liz Immer, head of product at Frontiers. We had a great chat with her about how this approach saved her company millions and how anyone can start applying it immediately. This was really good stuff.
So let's hit the music and get right to it. The Product Experience is brought to you by Mind the Product. Every week on the podcast, we talk to the best product people from around the globe.
Visit mindtheproduct.com to catch up on past episodes and discover loads of free resources to help you with your product practice. You can also find more information about Mind the Product's conferences and their great training opportunities happening around the world and online.
Create a free account on the website for a fully personalized experience and to get access to the full library of awesome content and the weekly curated newsletter. Mind the Product also offers free Product Tank meetups in more than 200 cities. There's probably one near you. Liz, thank you so much for joining us today. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me on this podcast experience. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, we're excited to have you. But for people who don't already know you, let's just do the quick introduction. Please tell us, what are you doing these days for a gig? And how did you get into this whole world of product stuff anyway?
Yeah, so these days, my title is Head of Product for Acceleration and Strategy at Frontiers, which is a publisher, a digital publisher in the scientific publishing space. And in that role, I am helping to incubate new product concepts and also facilitating strategy setting for various product teams and the department as a whole. And my path to this gig has been a circuitous one, as most product people's paths have been. My start wasn't in product. It started with a strong want to contribute to healing the world. I started in environmental regulation design and trying to figure out what kinds of laws could actually bring people to behave and invest in more environmentally friendly ways. So we started to look at how people tend to behave in conditions of uncertainty. We designed a computer game and invited people to play different variants of the game, even earning money for it. And we saw in that game that behaviors have some patterns, but actually people don't behave like the graphs we might have seen in our first semester economics would suggest. People don't maximize profits. And this isn't the first study that ever showed this, and there are, you know, by now even more that really corroborate this, but it was my first discovery. And from that moment, I was sort of hooked to, I really wanted to keep understanding better how people tick and use that knowledge to create a better world. So that's what I've been doing ever since. It's been like 15 years now in academia, studying cooperation, and in industry, doing things ranging from strategy consulting to usability testing, UX concept advising, and in the past 5 years or so, embedded into product organizations, leading design and product.
So this is, I mean, you're talking about behavioral science here, but can we just get a proper definition? Because that's what we're going to talk about today, is the way you use behavioral science in your product career and how you use it to design better experiences. But what exactly is behavioral science? How do we define it?
So I like to describe behavioral science as the intersection of economics and psychology. And by this, I mean that behavioral scientists are interested in understanding why people do what we do, how people take choices and take actions in their daily lives. And we know when we are honest with ourselves and honest when making observations of the world that humans tend not to be quite like Spock. Sometimes we describe Spock as being the perfectly rational Homo economicus who knows everything and incorporates all information perfectly and reacts exactly the right way. Humans don't do this. We're more like Homer Simpson, at least a lot of the time. We don't do the perfect thing. We often don't even do what we want to do. We eat a little bit too much. We exercise a little bit less than we should. We're more impulsive than we should be. So I think all of us can acknowledge this when we reflect on our own behavior and the rest of the world. And behavioral scientists are really interested in understanding what are the patterns that are evident, what are the heuristics, the shortcuts, the tricks that humans are using to navigate their way throughout the world. And the conviction is, and this is something that I experience every day, is that when we have a pretty good understanding of the biggest patterns that are guiding human behavior, we as product people, designers, I describe all product people as designers, can design products that are a little bit better at helping people make decisions that are in their best interest. And so that's been my work until today, developing products that that help people be better versions of themselves.
I love that you describe sort of all product people as designers. I tend to describe all engineers and designers as product people as well. So we're all just everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I tend to take this a little, one step even more meta, thinking about, you know, we're product designers in the sense of we might be designing a flow or an interface, but as leaders, we're also designing the product that is the work environment that we and our colleagues, our teams are operating in. And so when I'm working, I'm thinking about, you know, how can I use behavioral science to develop a work environment that's going to help me and everybody else do a better job to design a product that's going to help our customers in turn.
And tell us about some of your work at Swisscom. You had a particular case there where your kind of application or use of behavioral science really, really helped solve a problem.
Yeah, so this was one of the luckiest breaks of my career. It the story started pretty early in my life as a product person, and I was a consultant at that time. And Swisscom is the biggest, I think it's still the biggest telecommunications provider in Switzerland. It's certainly the oldest. It was the state-run telecommunications provider back in the day, and when it got liberalized. When the market became liberalized, they were still strong, but ran the risk of losing customers for the first time. And several years after this liberalization, Swisscom approached our little agency with a challenge. And they said, you know, it's true that, you know, most people in Switzerland do pay their bills. But we recognize that there's a trend in our society that delinquency is on the uptick. More people are, you know, living on the edge. And we are concerned about the prospect of losing customers and also, yeah, losing money. We want to try to reduce the number of people who are paying their bills late. And they said, we've been working on this for a long time. We made progress, but it's leveled out. We're not able to make any more progress. Can you fix this for us? And they said, you know, some of our senior managers think we should increase the penalty fees around bad behavior. Like, people who are bad, they deserve to be punished. So let's increase the penalties. And our clients at that time had a feeling like this is not the right answer, but they weren't sure how to proceed. And I and my team, we were really lucky that they approached us because it was an amazing project for all of us.
So I'm curious, you know, as you said, increasing the fees or penalties is a lot of times what they would initially go for. I'm curious, what else would a normal approach have been for something like this? Swisscom may not have had a lot of experience with this, but it's a collections is a well-known thing. So what would the KPIs, what would they normally optimize for in this type of situation? And what did you do differently?
Yeah, so I mentioned that in this industry, there are sort of two, I mentioned one of the sort of patterns of thinking that people who don't pay are bad people and they should be punished with stiffer penalties. And then there's another train of thought or strain of thinking that people who don't pay are a lost cause. And our hypothesis was that neither of these were the full truth. Normally in this industry, they're looking at KPIs like the number of outstanding bills or the time between when a bill is sent and the bill is paid, and the reaction from each level of consequence. And this is something that I was really impressed to learn. This was a new industry for me at that time as well, that, and I had never been one of these customers who didn't pay my bills for a very long time. So it was sort of a new audience for me, but listeners who have experimented with this will be familiar with, you start getting notifications. You tend to start getting really aggressive notifications pretty quickly. Pay your bill. You better pay your bill. You really need to pay your bill. Red text. Services start getting suspended, which is not a great feeling when you try to make a phone call and you can't, or you try to send an email, or you can't. And ultimately what happens is that the customers who have bills that are outstanding for enough time, their bill gets sent to a collections agency. And then, at least in the US, you get the proper red letter in your inbox. So historically, it's really been a very unpleasant experience to be delinquent in one's bills, even by a few weeks in some contexts. And that was where we started from.
So how did you approach this differently? How did you, like, what was the first steps that you took to think of it from a behavioral science way?
So in my case, I had the luck, I guess you could describe it, of having a pretty strong anchoring in behavioral science. And I had gotten that, I mean, I told you about my academic background, but also, especially at that time, I was reading lots of books and case studies, listening to a lot of podcasts, Poor Economics, Choiceology, really soaking up a lot of knowledge about human behavior. So I had an instinct that penalties might not be the best, or were probably not the best solution. But this was a hard belief to overcome in the organization because it was so commonly held, and also because businesses tend to earn revenue from penalty fees. So we also had to overcome that KPI. And again, I was so lucky to have an incredible boss at that time and clients who wanted to figure out a way to collect enough story, enough evidence, enough of an argument to enter a discussion with their senior management about what the appropriate course of action would be. So rather than jumping into the design work, we time boxed an early discovery phase. We time boxed it at something like 4 weeks, and we really dug into it in those 4 weeks. We did context analysis. We sat in the call center. We read more about behavioral science. How do people behave in this context? And that was under conditions of scarcity. Money is always scarce. Time is always scarce. And then we did an incredible user research initiative where we built an experience in our laboratory that was quite close to the real experience that customers had. So we collected all of the artifacts that customers were exposed to when they hadn't paid their bills. And we allowed people to walk us through their stories. So we couldn't follow them for 6 months. We didn't have the time. It was too expensive. But We invited a diverse group of individuals into our space, people who had been in a lot of debt, who had just been in a little bit, who were old and young and digital natives and not. And they shared what had happened to them and how they had experienced that process. And then we pulled it all together in a one day, very compressed design sprint. We invited the call center agents and the managers and the business analysts to each present their perspective, their expertise, brought it into the room together with the user research and the behavioral science. And that took 6 weeks. It was really intense. It was in the summer too. I remember we were sweating so much. But after that compressed, intensive 6 weeks pre-discovery, we were able to hit the ground running with design and delivery. And within 3 months, we had delivered the first solution, and it went really fast from there. So when it came to working on the actual solutions, again, this was thanks to the incredible product manager that I was working with at that time, Matthias Aschimann. We're really clever about selecting the opportunities that we thought would have the biggest impact and that would be the easiest and the fastest to make progress on. And, you know, just like all the books say, like, we focused on those, we got them right. And then we had a lot of evidence after a few months, and had a lot of buy-in to keep going. And we had an incredible few years.
How long did it take to get people on board with this approach? I mean, you said, you know, originally they were thinking about increasing fees and trying to force or guilt people into paying, and you took a more empathic approach. Was that, you said you went fairly quickly, it's an outside agency, so you kind of have a little more permission for these things, but how much work was there to get people ready to even try this?
This story is certainly one of the reasons that I continue to go around talking about behavioral science, even though, you know, behavioral science is not the only thing that I do in my work as a product person anymore, because we were able to move really fast by relying on work that a lot of other people had already done. So I mentioned that we did this intensive early discovery phase. Included in that was collating a lot of evidence from a lot of different studies in laboratories and in the real world, from Europe, from UK, from Africa, from South America. And we pulled this together into a series of interactive sessions that took place within one day. And, you know, sometimes I can speak in a fairly eloquent way, and sometimes I can deliver a message that is really moving. But that the upper management was so bought in by the end of the day is not thanks to, you know, my tone of voice or framing. It was thanks to having a lot of different data points already in the bag that we could pull together and build a lot of confidence around. So my clients certainly did some work, important work, in advance of that workshop day, but by the end of that day, you know, everybody was walking out of the room really bought in. And if I can share one initiative that that we did as part of the day that I think also really helped, and it sounds almost trivial, we named the project. And going into the day, the project had been called in German, Sanierung. Sounds a lot like sanitation. We're going to clean up. But during the day, we, of course, heard a lot of things. And one of the things we learned about was a phenomenon called the fresh start effect. And this is a phenomenon that's been written about extensively by Katie Milkman at Wharton Business School. And it describes that humans set much more ambitious goals for themselves and are much better at achieving them when they set those goals on the first day of a new life phase. It can be the first day of the year. It can be the first day of the month or the season or the week. First day is their fresh start. And so by the end of the day, this project had been named by the group Project Fresh. And that brought a tremendous amount of energy into this initiative, transforming it from something yucky to something awesome.
That's funny. I once had a project at it was an incredibly boring project, but we could decide to call it Project Clarence, and there was a whole reason behind this. But it was such a different naming convention than anything else in the company that people actually got behind it, and I never really thought about it that way.
And in this case, it was the same thing. Like, this team started getting internal applications from other employees at the company. This team that had not been terribly attractive before because they're dealing with this yucky topic. Branding, right? They inspired themselves and others.
Nice. So, like, you've built us all up with this story. I'm dying to know what the solution was and how you ultimately then did, you know, gain traction with the delinquent customers.
Yeah. So when we analyzed all of the data points that we collected, we were able to synthesize them into two main behavioral drivers: ability to pay, and motivation to pay. And we plotted all of the customers who we had interacted with across a matrix where we had one axis being ability and one motivation. And we recognized that while in our sample and in general, there are some people who are really not able to do this target behavior and others who are not motivated, who might be really angry or just really don't believe in paying bills. You know, there are some extremes. We believed that there was also a sizable mass of people who, you know, it just wasn't the top of their priority list. They weren't, you know, super motivated to do it. And they had money, or maybe they just didn't have money. They weren't paying because they might not have had money on the right day when the bill came. So we decided to tackle these lower hanging fruits of people who were pretty motivated and pretty capable. And we redesigned the timing and the channels and the touch points that we were sending information on. And this was in 2017. Like, we were missing a lot of the fancy technological solutions that are available now. It was simple looking back. But, you know, earlier there had been a philosophy that, you know, we don't want to bother our customers any more than we need to. So customers weren't reminded until 30 days after the bill was due. And we realized there are a lot of people who just forget. So we started to send them a reminder 5 days after the bill was due and said, you know, like, just a reminder. And if you pay by this date in 2 weeks or 3 weeks, you're not going to get charged that penalty fee. So it was a friendly move. And we also baked behavioral science into it. Those who know about some of these phenomenon caught the loss aversion frame. So we made it such that customers would want to avoid the loss that they would incur if they had a penalty fee, and they were highly motivated to get active now. And lots of different things like that. We just treated customers as we would want to be treated. Be reminded before my service gets cut off, and things like that. Give me the chance to take action. We transformed the letters from being very numbers-based, looking very technical with a lot of tables, to looking more human as well. So rather than writing out a date of a deadline, we wrote things like Monday, the 15th of March is when your deadline is. And we did this also because we know that human brains are really bad at handling numbers. We push away from contexts where there are a lot of numbers because it's too hard for us. But words are better, and words describing the future also make the future much more salient to us. So it becomes easier to imagine that I'm going to be in a worse situation on Tuesday, the 16th of March, if I haven't acted before then. So we did a lot of different tweaks within these touch points. And you asked about the results. The results were tremendous. So we have this amazing graph where we see the number of outstanding bills 30 days, 60 days, 90 days after the deadline. And after we introduced the first tweaks to this process, we saw that the number of bills open after 30 days was almost zero. And customer satisfaction of customers who were delinquent, as measured by NPS, increased by 30 points and stayed up there permanently. And Swisscom saved, I think the number on our slide was 10 million francs within 2 years, thanks to these tweaks. So they changed customer behavior. They saw a market increase in satisfaction, all without punishing.
I think it's important to note for anyone who doesn't know the exchange rate for francs, and I don't know it off the top of my head, but francs are more valuable than the dollar. So it's not one of those things where they saved 10 million francs and it turned out to be $35. This is a real savings.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling that out, Randy. I'm too in my Swiss frame. It's about something like $10 million at that time within 2 years.
So did that change the behavior of the team at Swisscom? Did they then start to approach their projects in a more behavioral science way and looking at problems in a really different way?
They absolutely did. So our client, who I've mentioned a few times, Matthias, ended up also doing a postgraduate degree in customer behavior after this project, and he's now a head of product also at another organization. The team leaned hard into the behavioral science approach and continued to. We had together a number of follow-up projects where we worked on things like installment plans, other kinds of billing touch points, portals online, giving customer guidance at various stages. And every single one of those initiatives has been guided by what we learned from their users in the scope of this project that I've been talking about, and also the frameworks that we developed and used together.
Liz, the way you've described a lot of this is, you know, tell a good story, get the permission, do the discovery, do some collaborative iterative design work, work with good designers and content designers, all kinds of things that you're doing. And we've heard all this kind of stuff before, and to be honest, it sounds a bit like a dream. But when I first met you, you were teaching a course at a conference about how to apply the behavioral science approach. And I suspect there's more to it than just that. So can you talk a little bit about how you've put this into an approach?
Yeah, thank you for the question. And it is amazing how fluffy, I guess, the story can sound. It's a broken record. Everybody loves to tell stories like that. So it's true that the user research and all of these interviews we ran were strongly informed by really strong hypotheses. And that's sort of the secret sauce, these really strong hypotheses. And we didn't prove, you know, we did invalidate some of those very strong hypotheses, and that's also important. But we used a pretty awesome framework for developing those hypotheses. And this is one of the things that I've been teaching people in the years since that I recognize has been really helpful. So I'm really happy to explain it in short today. So we frame problems as behavioral problems. This is a term that we like to use. And when we're framing a behavioral problem, the first step is identifying the target behavior, the goal. Josh Seiden likes to describe this as a desired outcome, but it's something that we want people to do. And one mistake I observe a lot of also good product people making is describing things like, I want them to think blah, 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 or I want them to feel blah, blah, blah. This is maybe a desired outcome for Josh Seiden, but it is not a target behavior. A target behavior is something we want people to do. We want them in this story to pay the bills on time. And then when we have the target behavior defined, I visualize this as a piece of paper with a blue sticky note in the middle with the target behavior. And then this paper becomes like a force field, sort of. And actually, this is described as Lewin's force field in some communities. And the idea is that there are forces that push people to do that behavior, and also forces that pull people away from doing that behavior. And we want to get as crystal clear as we can about what those forces are that are bringing people to do it or taking them away from doing it. And we can break these forces down into categories. I call the forces that are bringing us to do something the benefits. And this comes from my background in economics, where we are weighing costs and benefits. And we recognize that people tend to do something when the benefits are high. In traditional economics, we talk about financial benefits. So when we're going to get a lot of money from something or feel like it's really cheap. But the psychology in behavioral science and the additional data points that behavioral scientists have uncovered show very clearly that money matters, but it's not the only thing that matters. And there are two more categories. One are the psychological benefits. And these are the ones that a lot of UX designers go to first. We want to make it beautiful. We want to make it fun, gamify, right? We want to make it feel good. And those are important. And then there's a third category that is the category that I see most often forgotten or neglected, but is also tremendously important. And that category are the social benefits. Humans are herd animals. We love belonging to the group. We love getting recognition from the group. We love, in most cases, doing what we think other people are doing or what they think they should be doing or what they think we should be doing. We get a lot of utility from that. So when we're looking at a target behavior, we're considering what are the financial, the psychological, and the social benefits that are bringing people or could be bringing people to do that thing. And on the other hand, what are the costs? What are the things that are pulling people away? What are the financial costs, the actual money, the psychological costs, the frictions, the change in habits, the contradiction with personal values, ethics? And what are the social costs? Because these matter in a big way too. It's expensive for me to do something that's different from what my peers are doing. And so we are really intentional about brainstorming in a first instance, what could be the costs and benefits that matter in this context, enhancing those brainstorms with data points from, you know, existing UX research or from competitor analysis, behavioral science literature, whatever, and then test them in our context. So I can give you one example. We thought that social costs mattered a lot in this context of the bills. And there was a beautiful example from the UK that had shown that a message explaining that most other British residents have paid on time. And this messaging in a letter got a lot more people to pay. So we tried to introduce that message into a prototype for this Swisscom reminder letter. And I am so glad we did it in a laboratory setting. It was the best money ever spent
people got so angry, they, when they had it on paper, they ripped it up and they threw it in the trash can, even though it was just a usability. Yeah.
This is nudge theory, though, right? This is that's following from that look at the world.
Well, nudges are doing what I've been describing. Nudges are designs that are designers' attempts to make the smallest possible change to an environment that will bring about the desired behavior. And, you know, you can pull lots of nudges from a Google search or a ChatGPT discussion or the book Nudge. And sometimes the nudges that are published will work in your case, but sometimes they won't. So the thoughtful approach here to be considering what matters in this context and then testing the prototype help to get it righter the first time you go live with the thing. And yeah, we were really glad that people weren't so angry in their houses ripping up their letters, but rather just doing it in our little lab.
I mean, I don't know what that says about the cultural difference between the English and the Swiss, but it's very funny.
Yeah. It's a cultural difference for sure. And it's also a branding difference. I think that letter in the UK was coming from the tax authority and this was coming from a company. And I think probably that matters too.
Yeah, it makes sense. So some of the language that you use in kind of what you describe around this force field and then you're kind of pushing forces and your pulling forces, it sounds very similar to language in like jobs to be done or like a value proposition canvas. So it's sort of familiar, but tell me a little bit more about like how you use it or how you kind of apply it. So once you have all of that information, like then what do you do with it? How do you take that forward then into next steps?
I really appreciate the question. And it's a question that I've been getting more and more frequently. I think because more and more people are becoming familiar with jobs to be done and impact mapping canvas or approach as well. And I'm certainly not advocating neglecting these other frameworks. I think I approach this as a complement to other frameworks. And it's important to consider, to take the first example from your question, the jobs to be done framework. And Randy, this goes to something that we were discussing a few weeks ago as well. In the case of the story that I'm presenting, paying the bill, it's a pretty clear-cut issue, right? People generally have a job to be done. Like they want to stay out of dire financial problems. So there isn't much to debate there. But in other cases, there are. If we as a tech company identify a target behavior that is not in line with a user's target behavior, we can quickly get into sticky issues in terms of ethics and in terms of long-term relationships with our customers. And there's also a discussion in the past years, an important discussion around the concerns of sludge. So we're nudging people to behave in certain ways, but actually we're either annoying them with all of these nudges we're throwing at people and or pushing them in directions that they don't want to go. And when I find myself in conversations about these issues, the question of, is the target behavior that we as a business have defined appropriate? I also go back again to this behavioral science framework, and this time to the framework technically called dual process theory. And some of the listeners for sure know this because Daniel Kahneman won a Nobel Prize about this. He wrote a really thick book called Thinking Fast and Slow, describing the way that our brains work. And the way that Kahneman and his co-author Amos Tversky describe it as our brains are working in two systems. a fast system and a slow system. So system one is the fast one, and it's amazing. It's the one that's getting us through the day. It's the one that's responding to the nudges. So like if they put the donuts closer to you, you're going to take it with system one. Or if they put the fruit basket closer to you at the cash register, you're just going to go for it with system one most of the time. And this is what a lot of the nudges that have been built into our digital products are relying on, right? They're relying that we are most of the time we're in a reactive state. Because we are, 95% of our day is driven, managed by this automatic part of our brain, system one. But there's a catch to that, and it is that we also have a system two. System two is slower, it's reflective, it searches for missing information, and it does react. Once it recognizes something. And what we know is that, you know, there is a 5% of the day, and at some point it's likely that a user or a customer will be confronted with a thought about our products during this 5% of the day. Maybe they come to the thought by themselves. Maybe it comes up at the dinner table over drinks with their friends. And when a customer recognizes, when they're in that reflective state, that they've been pulled away from their job to be done by a nudge that our product has implemented, they're not very likely to stay a loyal, cooperative customer for very long. And so it's really important to have this reflection in our work environment, this time for us to get into system two, into our reflective modes. And I think the frameworks, the diversity of frameworks can be really helpful in helping us challenge our ideas and even these target behaviors that we're identifying.
Liz, this has been a fantastic conversation, and I don't want it to end, but we are kind of running out of time. So I'm going to ask one last question on this, and that's for the people who are listening. You've talked about some practical things in terms of the framework, but what's one thing that people can do that can put into their practice tomorrow to start implementing or including behavioral science approaches into their work?
The best trick I've seen people do is to pick up this idea of the costs and benefits. Start there. Write down the target behavior and think it through for yourself. You might even recognize that it's inappropriate. Hopefully not. Hopefully you'll draw a little table for yourself, costs on one side, benefits on another side. Make three rows for financial, psychological, and social. Costs and benefits that you think matter, and start to test those, maybe just through thought experiments, maybe through user research. And what I see in almost every single behavioral challenge and also almost every single product situation is that there is one aspect of those costs and benefits that matters a lot more than we tend to think. And it is partnership. I talked about humans being herd animals. We like to belong. We also like to cooperate as a default. When we're in environments that we think we're being cheated or tricked, we stop cooperating. So as a product designer, I think one of our number one goals should be to avoid that. So avoid tricking. And prioritize partnership. Do as much as you can for your user and your customer, and that will increase exponentially the likelihood that they're going to cooperate with you in whatever way you ask them to the next time you do.
Liz, thank you so much. This has been so great. I think that's such a good tip. I love it.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure to speak with you, and I hope this was helpful for at least a few people.
I'm sure it will be.
Yeah, more than a few.
The Product Experience is the first
and the best
podcast from Mind the Product. Our hosts are me, Lily Smith.
And me, Randy Silver.
Lou Ron Pratt is our producer and Luke Smith is our editor.
Our theme music is from Hamburg-based band POW, that's P-A-U. Thanks to Arnie Kittler, who curates both Product Tank and MTP Engage in Hamburg, and who also plays bass in the band, for letting us use their music. You can connect with your local product community via Product Tank, regular free meetups in over 200 cities worldwide.
If there's not one near you, maybe you should think about starting one. To find out more, go to mindtheproduct.com/producttank.